This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. David Levering Lewis is a professor at New York University and one of the nation's preeminent historians. His definitive two-volume biography of W.E.B. Du Bois won the Pulitzer Prize twice, one for each volume. In 2010, President Barack Obama awarded Lewis the National Humanities Medal.
And it's his intimate scholarship of Du Bois, the Massachusetts-born sociologist, activist, and co-founder of the NAACP, that inspired Lewis to take a basic criticism Du Bois offered of 1930s America and see how it settles across the landscape of the contemporary recession-weary United States.
More than 70 years ago, Lewis writes that Du Bois predicted two paths for the nation, one based on freedom and intelligence for all man, the other in service to industry, determined at any price to amass wealth and power.
How successfully the country has resolved or not resolved these two antithetical versions of itself is the subject of Lewis's most recent paper that appears in Daedalus, the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. David Levering Lewis joins us now from New York. Professor Lewis, welcome to Radio Boston.
It's good to be here.
It's a true pleasure to have you. And I was quite enthralled with your paper as I read over it over the past few days. And let me just start with the basic question. In your mind, what is, how would you define America's sense of itself, this concept of American exceptionalism, as you put it in the paper?
Well, it's a big topic, and that's why a good number of thinkers contributed to this issue of Daedalus on the American narrative, looking back and looking at the present. I suppose Alexis de Tocqueville got much of it right, jump-starting what we think about the American narrative, and that is a melting pot of people whose commitment to democracy comes along also with a view that progress is infinite and that the past, though of some significance, really is not a fetter or a handicap to Americans as they move forward. That, in fact, we are always moving into the future, and most of us are benefiting from that trajectory.
But as you note, I'm sorry to interrupt, Professor, but as you even note in the paper, I mean, Tocqueville was writing in the 19th century, and even then he said, and yet the great obstacle to this course that he believed the country could follow was, of course, its grand hypocrisy about race.
That's true. He identified that flaw early on, and I think that perceptive commentators on this topic have always noted that as good as things get and have gotten decade by decade, there has always been, until recent times and perhaps yet and still, the anomaly of racism of a large percentage of the population who, by virtue of pigment, do not benefit from the manna at the table of American democracy.
Professor Lewis, so that brings us to why you, I mean, you talk about Tocqueville in the paper. You also talk about other 19th century observers of the United States. But then, I mean, my mind was particularly captured when you brought in W.E.B. Du Bois, obviously, who was writing in the early 20th century. Black scholar, sociologist, activist, founder of the NAACP, as we talked about. And we'll talk a little bit more about him and his life in a moment. But it was interesting because you noted that the phrase American exceptionalism, that phrase in particular, didn't really come into popular usage until much, much, much later. But in the 19-teens, 20s, and 30s, here comes Du Bois, who writes about what he calls the American assumption. Now, for him, what was that assumption? What did he describe as was being assumed? It seemed this two-part choice, as you write in the paper.
Yes. Well, that's an insight that Du Bois records in a major work of his, a work of history, Black Reconstruction in America, which was published in 1935. But curiously enough, I think I can take some credit for paying attention to a term that Du Bois used that had been rather underserved for its value. That is, he spoke of the American assumption, and by that he meant basically the belief that the market economy and the light hold upon the culture of history and the belief that many people can collaborate to make the society better, that assumption had one important limitation, and it was that if the economics of the American experience were monopolized by a small number of people, it would denature, it would limit, it would corrupt this vision of participatory America, this vision of an America of shining tomorrows where most Americans fully participated in the movement.
Professor Lewis, at the time that W.E.B. Du Bois was writing this and exploring this notion, this idea that there's the fear or concern of, as you were saying, the monopoly of wealth and power and influence, was he speaking regarding the country as a whole, or specifically that monopoly would fall to white Americans and not Americans of any color, since race was still so much of a preeminent issue at the time?
Well, I think that Du Bois really was addressing the large problem of social democracy. And his view was that the real problem of wealth, of race, was a problem of wealth, its maldistribution. It's true that he famously said that the problem of his century, the 20th century, was the color line. And many people think that that was the sum and substance of what he was getting at. But he really meant, as he wrote more, that race or color is a function of class, and class is determined by wealth. And that to the degree that wealth it becomes maldistributed and concentrated at the top, to that degree, class and progress and race, that these things become increasingly difficult to negotiate, difficult to prevent marginalization and oppression and denial of resources.
You know what's interesting to me, though, is that you pointed out maybe some contradictions within Du Bois himself, because there's a section of the paper where you write that he felt as if, quote, captains of unregulated wealth were already the winners in the 1930s in this contest between his two ideas about America's future, this idea of freedom and power for all versus an autocracy, essentially, amassing this wealth. You say that he already felt that those captains of unregulated wealth had won that competition. But you also call him a sociologist prone to Marxist hyperbole. So do you think he was being excessively critical of the country at the time?
I don't think so. He wrote this book in which his criticism was particularly formulated sharply in the middle of the Great Depression. He began thinking about it soon after the collapse of the market, and finally the book appears in 1935. Surely he was rather in good company at the time with many American intellectuals and historians, sociologists, who believed that the economic or the political economy of the country had gotten out of balance, and that the excessive amassment of wealth the control of the political decision-making of the country in the hands of the rich, the plutocracy, had indeed created a calamity, the Great Depression. And he hoped that, as he was writing, that the New Deal and its reforms, economic and social, were countervailing forces which, at the end of the day, would not only correct the imbalance, but guarantee that that imbalance would be kept at bay.
Hmm. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning historian David Levering Lewis. He's written extensively about the great Massachusetts-born sociologist and co-founder of the NAACP, W.E.B. Du Bois, and particularly how Du Bois's assertion in 1935 that America faced a choice between freedom and power for all or an autocracy determined to amass wealth at any price. Professor Lewis says the country faces the same question today. So do you agree? After the Great Recession, listeners, in the midst of continuing unemployment and continuing struggles with home ownership, the rise of globalization, do you think the country has chosen one of these paths? Or is the Du Bois-Lewis analysis maybe a little too strict or too unimaginative? Does America continue to be exceptional because it can hold freedom and wealth side by side? What's your question for our great historian, David Levering Lewis? Call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Professor Lewis, I wonder if we might take a step back for a moment before we sort of jump into contemporary America and how W.E.B. Du Bois's thinking and scholarship might apply today. And this is my opportunity. I'd love to explore a little bit with you about Du Bois, the man himself. I mean, he was born in Great Barrington here in Massachusetts, went to Harvard, co-founded the NAACP. What was his life like in particular, you think, that might have led him to be such a sort of loyal critic of the economic system of the United States in the early 20th century?
Du Bois said at the end of his long career that if he had been born white, he probably would not have become the probing critic of the society, of his society that he became. That was to say that he had no choice to be more sensitive. He had no choice but to have antennae that picked up the inconsistencies and the anomalies and the unfairnesses of American society insofar as race and class, and he would later say gender, were concerned. But I think one shouldn't be too reductionist and say that because Du Bois was black, he's an angry critic. You would expect it, Harvard degree or no, or University of Berlin degree or no. I think Du Bois was typical of the atypical. That is to say, he was part of an increasingly critical group of thinkers in 20th century America who were called progressives, who, loyal citizens, patriots to the man and to the woman, nonetheless saw that the very great abundance and the very great power of the American economy made it possible to accommodate greater justice and prosperity to optimize these things, to maximize these things. And so their criticism was not one of disloyalty, nor did they think that America was not a going concern to be applauded, but that because it was a going concern, the applause should come with criticism, with insight, and with concern for democracy.
Mm. And that leads, I mean, that makes so much sense as to why you point out in the paper that, for example, I mean, Du Bois even identified, 1820 roughly to 1860 as, to a certain degree, a real golden period in the United States where this idea that individualism and freedom could actually live in harmony with capitalism and economic growth, at least, yes, at least for white men.
At least for white men. That's true. That was a time when industry and frugality and discipline and some good luck approximated the ideal of rewards that would come to people who worked hard. And what he hoped was that with the Civil War, the exclusion of an entire population from that kind of progress would end. And for a brief period, he thought that the Reconstruction period held great promise for an America that acknowledged the value of the progress, the promise of its darker citizens, and that indeed their collaboration with whites in the South had led to a remarkable degree of civil society that one would not have imagined possible before 1865. Mm. But that didn't last. Reconstruction ends, and with it the experiment in biracial democracy, should we say, and it's followed by a rather grim period of ostracism, persecution, and constitutional fraudulence.
Well, I do wonder, Professor Lewis, in that case, I mean, you bring up the example of the Civil War, which is, of course, one of the great sort of social, economic, and political cataclysms in U.S. history. And then you also later, you've spoken about the Great Depression, also major cataclysm of sorts in the American history. Is it possible to look at those two points as essentially the country going through a period of self-correction? You know, that this tension between, Du Bois's two futures for America, it periodically gets resolved, and it gets resolved on its own in whatever way the United States manages to make that resolution. Essentially, it can self-correct. So, and successfully, I mean, would Du Bois have seen it that way?
I think Du Bois would have seen that there's a permanent possibility for correction in the American social contract. Whether or not that possibility still obtains is to be thought about, I suppose. But yes, and that's what the Civil War was all about, rectifying one great obscenity, and that's what the New Deal was about, making the society work in a way that economic democracy became somewhat institutionalized. If today we have another opportunity because of the Great Recession to make that choice between freedom and intelligence and power for all men and women, as Du Bois said, or the antithetical version based on industry for private profit directed by an autocracy determined at any price to amass wealth and power— those are the choices, and we are perhaps again at a fork in the road.
I'm speaking with Professor David Levering Lewis. He's a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and possibly one of the nation's experts on the life and scholarship of the great black sociologist and activist W.E.B. Du Bois. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Professor Lewis, there are a couple people who'd love to speak with you, so I'd like to bring them into the conversation, if that's okay.
Please do.
Let's go to Newton, where Bo is calling. Bo, you're on the air.
Thank you very much, Professor. I really appreciate the scholarship. There's a gentleman named Eugene Robinson who argues that black America is now split into five groups, what he calls the transcendent, the mainstream, the abandoned, and two emergent groups, those who are Haitians, Native Africans, and so on, and those who are biracial or multiracial like my own kids. I wonder how you see Du Bois's thinking from the 20th century into the 21st century in terms of the splintering of black America.
Bo, thank you for your call.
Yes, thanks very much. I think the Robinson characterization of class and color at this point in our history is helpful. I think Du Bois would assent to that schema. Indeed, if I were to be able to reach for one of his writings, I remember that it predicted that with the dismantlement of apartheid, that is, the Brown versus Board era beginning, that black America would become increasingly stratified, and that the solidarity, to the degree it had once obtained, would fray as class interests and indeed even cultural interests competed for the Golden Ring. He would, I think, though, also say that the transcendent in Mr. Robinson's paradigm probably are not on the same glide path that they might have anticipated since 2008. That is to say, if the grim figures and percentiles are to be believed, that 1% of the population controls an inordinate amount of the rest of the population's wealth, something like 1% controlling 43% of the nation's wealth, and of that 1%, an even minuscule percentage controls even more. You would not think that transcendency is really as embedded and institutionalized as the characterization suggests. In other words, we are at a moment in which the ability to make democracy work becomes structurally a fantasy if, because of the in a Citizens United America, the power of money is unfettered, uncontrolled, and directed by an infinitesimally small group, then democracy becomes illusory, and the idea of mobility and of prosperity well distributed becomes a mirage.
But Professor Lewis, on that point, I wonder if I might ask, you know, there many might hear you speaking now and say they believe the exact opposite is true about the United States, that in a way you have to have, as a nation, a certain degree of willful naivete or just the belief in what is possible in order to not be a sclerotic nation, in order to continue to evolve. So while some people might see this, the continuing I guess American exceptionalism as more like American exclusionism by excluding more and more groups from what is the American dream, other people might see that, no, that's not true, that basically what it is, it's American vitality instead.
Well, I suppose there is always the half full, half empty business about the glass. But what would be the indicia that would make one's pessimism worth pondering? I think it would be the fact that education, the strong suit of our society, American higher education, had been the wonder of the globe. It now has priced itself to a degree that it is unaffordable to most people and to those people who matriculate through it. Debt confronts them at the end of the pipeline, so that mobility in America, the great belief, can now be demonstrated no longer to obtain. That is to say that for the past 10 to 15 years, the prediction that you were born in one group and would be better off than your parents is no longer accurately demonstrable.
Professor Lewis, I'm sorry to jump in there, but we just have about a little over a minute to go, and I did want to ask you one final question that sort of brings us all home. Because, I mean, we started this conversation with your really fascinating analysis of Du Bois's idea that the United States has a choice. He stated it in 1935 again as this choice between freedom and power for all versus an autocracy that amasses power at any cost. And that you state in the paper that you believe Du Bois's question applies today as well. And it's interesting because there's a lot of talk in the country now about, you know, the American dream, whether it's still available to our to all. NPR is doing a series on it right now. Daedalus, the journal where your paper appeared, devoted an entire issue to this. And in fact, in that same issue, Lawrence Tribe, famous constitutional scholar at Harvard University, he wrote that the idea of America is we the people, right? And it's a result of an ongoing contest between competing narratives. So in a sense, this conflict has to persist. It must maintain for us, for the American character itself to even exist. I mean, would you agree with that? Can you imagine this country without that conflict?
There's conflict can be therapeutic, cathartic. If, however, the game is rigged, and the conflict then is not productive of changed results, I think Lawrence Tribe's statement is a statement for the moment, but not for the future.
Mm. David Levering Lewis is the Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. He's written a two-part biography of W.E.B. Du Bois. He's also a professor of history at New York University. His latest paper about W.E.B. Du Bois and the changing American narrative appears in Daedalus. It's the Journal of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences. Professor Lewis, such a pleasure to speak with you. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure to have been here. Thank you.
And listeners, continue this conversation online, as always, at radioboston.org. Coming up, some ideas for your weekend, plus a preview of the Boston Book Festival's choice for this year's One City, One Story program. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston.